The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I think we're going to start this afternoon's panel, if everyone can come in and get seated. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. My name is Molly Bruder. I'm the Associate Symposium Editor for the American University Law Review, and it's my honor to introduce to you panel three. The panel is entitled Inside the Schoolhouse Gates, the Tinker Doctrine and the Current Controversies over Religious Speech, Teacher Speech, and Viewpoint Discrimination. I'll introduce this afternoon's moderator, who's Miriam Arangiani. Professor Arangiani is an adjunct professor here at American University Washington College of Law, and she's the regional director for Kaplan. Professor Arangiani is in charge of the nationwide outreach for the Marshall Brennan Constitutional Literacy Project, and she's the former assistant director of WCL's program on law and government. Ms. Arangiani has co-authored the book Youth Justice in America, and we're pleased to have her moderating this afternoon's panel. I'll turn it over to her. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone, Tinker lovers. It's nice to see you all. The structure for this panel is going to be a little bit different than the previous two. I understand I unfortunately had to step out to go speak on another panel downstairs, but I understand that there's been a lot more lively questions asked by previous moderators, and we're actually going to allow each of the four panelists, in the interest of having four, to speak for about 15 to 20 minutes each, and then if you have any questions, please jot them down. We will definitely take them during the last session immediately following this one. Before I turn this over to our distinguished panelists, I'd like to give you a brief introduction to each of them, who they are, and why they're here today. First, Eric Zimmerman. He is the staff counsel at the American Center for Law and Justice, ACLJ. At ACLJ, Mr. Zimmerman represents clients regarding free speech and religious liberty issues, including high school and college students and student organizations. He's authored several law review articles over the years, and received his JD at Regent University, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Regent Law Review. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in political science from Niagara University. Thank you very much, Eric, for joining us. Our second panelist is Alex Wohl. Am I saying your name right? Great. Alex Wohl, who is communications director for the American Constitution Society. He has a distinguished career in communications, including serving as director of communications at the U.S. Department of Education, where he served as a speechwriter for then-Secretary of Education Richard Riley. He also served as director of public affairs for the American Federation of Teachers, and he previously served as a judicial fellow at the U.S. Supreme Court. He had more traditional legal jobs, I would say, prior to that, as a law clerk for Judge Guy on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and as an associate at Dickstein Shapiro. He serves as adjunct professor at AU in the Department of Justice, Law, and Society, and has authored numerous articles related to education, legal affairs, and entertainment. He received his JD from WCL and BA from Brandeis University. Thank you, Alex, for joining us. Next, Frank Lamonti is executive director of the Student Press Law Center. He advocates for free speech rights for students and student journalists and provides information, advice, and legal assistance at no charge to students and the educators who work with them. He previously practiced commercial litigation with an Atlanta-based law firm, Sutherland Aspel, and also clerked for federal judges on the Northern District of Georgia and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Before attending law school at the University of Georgia, Mr. Lamonti was an award-winning investigative journalist and political columnist in state capitol bureaus in Florida and Georgia and in Washington, D.C. While he was at the University of Georgia, he served as a senior editor of the Georgia Law Review. Thank you very much, Frank. Finally, Sam Harbin, also a Georgia man, obtained his JD from the University of Georgia Law School, and over the years has represented public school districts in Georgia and founded and was a founding partner of Harbin and Hartley It's a law firm that does all sorts of education law. He serves as on the board of directors of the National School Boards Association, Council of School Attorneys. In addition to his representation of school systems, he has taught school law for teachers at North Georgia College and State University and Nova University. He's also a published author, in addition to our other panels, and is I think, going to round out the panel very nicely with some of his practical experience. The other three panelists have written pieces for the symposium edition, and he's going to sort of contribute his real-life experience over the past 40 years or so in the area of education. So thank you very much. Again, we're going to give each panelist about 15 to 20 minutes to present their ideas on this topic. And please, again, for those of you who just walked in, please hold on to your questions, and we will take them during the next session.
Thank you. The title of our piece is Tinker at 40, Defending the Right of High School Students to Wear Controversial Religious and Pro-Life Clothing. And the word controversial we put in quotes because one of the basic thesis of our article is that there should be broad protection for quote-unquote controversial speech, including religious and political speech, or speech that touches on sensitive social issues. And the reason for controversial in quotes is, in a sense, all religious speech, all political speech or social speech could be viewed as controversial, in that there's someone in the audience that's probably going to disagree with that, and oftentimes in very strong terms. But the principle is that, going back to the Tinker case, controversial speech is exactly what is protected under Tinker. Obviously, you have the substantial disruption standard, but the default rule is that should be that students' speech is protected unless the school can show that it's that the likelihood of disruption is significant enough. There's a few interesting things that or issues that cut across a lot of the different panelists that probably spoke today. One of them is just the issue of how do you view high school students? Particularly, you have students that are juniors or seniors. Many of them are 16, 17, 18 years old, who are already eligible or will be soon eligible to vote. In some states, many states, they can get married. How do you treat them? Do you treat them primarily or view them as adults or soon-to-be adults that are getting ready to be out in society as the next set of leaders and employees and teachers, or should we still primarily view them as students in the sense of they're still teenagers or children that are not quite ready to participate in the marketplace of ideas? And a similar theme along those lines is, what is the kind of principle or purpose for protecting student speech? Is it to allow them to actually influence public policy through parents and through community issues, or is it to kind of give them an experiment in democracy? Is it to allow them to essentially have, if you will, training wheels experience of learning how to interact with people about important issues? And those are some themes that come up a lot in the opinions in some of the cases that deal with those issues. One of the other things that I came across is our article focuses primarily on pro-life or abortion-related speech and speech dealing with issues like gay marriage, some of the current cultural issues. And it really seems that a lot of, in a sense, that's one of the cutting-edge areas of student speech in our current setup, because a lot of our article focuses on some of the four or five key lower court opinions within the last several years that deal with those kinds of issues. And oftentimes, especially at the appellate level, Court of Appeals, a lot of the decisions are 2-1, and there's a sharp split. And the majority opinion and the dissenting opinions are on opposite pages, and not just on the outcome of the case, but on just some basic philosophical questions. And so in a sense, in my opinion, the pro-life or gay marriage related issues are kind of the current one of the cutting edge issues, in addition to things like the scope of the school to reach to electronic means, which I believe was covered earlier today. Another thing that I noticed that it's not always true, but it's just kind of a general trend. To me, especially the Tinker case and a lot of the general free speech cases of the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s outside of the school context, primarily you could classify the speaker many times as a, quote-unquote, a liberal or progressive viewpoint, whether it would be an anti-war protest or something along those lines, where it seems that a lot of the most controversial cases today, not all, but a good percentage, are on the other side of the political spectrum, whether it's a student who's got a kind of aggressive pro-life message on a T-shirt or someone that is wearing a shirt that proclaims their view of the Bible as it deals with homosexuality. I mean, that's not always the case. There, one of the prominent cases from the last several years involved a student who wore a shirt that basically declared that President Bush is an international terrorist. Obviously, that would be not on the conservative side of the spectrum, but generally speaking, I just find that interesting in a sense, not that it so much plays into the cases, but in a way it seems that a lot of these school districts or government, local governments in the formative cases were essentially conservative, so to speak, trying to suppress an anti-war message, where a lot of the school districts today, at least in the case law, appear to be either promoting their own message that is more progressive, so to speak, or seeking to minimize a conservative message. In terms of the cases, I mean, I won't go into detail on the basic Supreme Court cases, but there's portions of each of the leading ones that really seem to play into the issue of religious or pro-life student speech. Starting with the Barnett case and going into Tinker, I think those two cases really stand out for the idea of what actually, what level is a substantial disruption? Because on a daily basis, when you, whether you're an attorney for a school board or a superintendent, a teacher, or an attorney for a student, that's one of the main issues that comes up, is what likelihood is this particular T-shirt, or it could be a hat or an armband, likely to substantially cause disruption in the school? What level do you have to show? Does there have to be a past history? And I think the Barnett case, although it didn't deal with the Tinker standard, and Tinker itself set the bar high for a school district to meet to show substantial disruption, because the Barnett case involved a student who would not recite the Pledge of Allegiance, but that happened during the context of World War II, and at a time obviously where patriotism and nationalism was at a high. It was, I believe, the opinion was in 1943, but I believe the actual refusal to pledge was not too far away from when Pearl Harbor occurred, before or after. But in any event, that's a very, I'm sure for a lot of the students at the school, teachers at the school, for a student to say, I'm not going to recite to the pledge, that's something that would upset a lot of people. But the court held in that case that you have the right to not be compelled to speak in that setting. And then moving forward to the Tinker case, obviously Vietnam War era is well known for being a time of turmoil and disruption and controversy, and yet a student could wear a black armband citing their views on that, and that was held to not be a substantial disruption. In fact, Justice Black's dissenting opinion pointed out, as often is the case in opinions, the dissenting opinion points out facts that the majority opinion conveniently fails to not include, and some of Justice Black's facts were that there were comments made, there some older students had made quote-unquote warnings to the students about what would happen if they wore those armbands. There was a math class that was wrecked, as Justice Black called it, and yet those facts did not establish a substantial disruption that would justify suppressing the, or requiring the students to not wear the armbands. And as that relates to the current issues, whether it's abortion or gay rights or marriage, those are certainly controversial hot button issues to this day and will probably continue to be for a long time. But the question is, are they so much more, even to the level of the Vietnam War issue, if not less than that? And so does the simple fact that a student wears a shirt that even touches upon the issue rise to the level of likely creating a substantial disruption? There's no judge that has really specifically said that, but there's some a few opinions that have kind of, especially on the issue of gay marriage, it doesn't take very much on a shirt in order for the school to have the ability to require that shirt to not be worn at school. Moving on to the Fraser case, it involved lewd and offensive sexual innuendo at a presentation, but one of the key applications to the issues in our article is how that applies to cases not involving sexual speech. Specifically, some courts had read that case as involving schools being allowed to minimize offensive speech and or speech that is likely to upset the school's educational mission. And that's an issue that has come up a lot in the lower court cases. It was addressed in the Morse Supreme Court case a few years ago, but that still is an issue that's not 100% decided on the scope of that. The Hazelwood case, it really doesn't have much relevance, in my opinion, to the issue of student T-shirts, primarily because it involves school-sponsored speech like newspapers. But there is some language in there, especially in Justice Brennan's dissent, about the extent to which schools can limit speech that conflicts with their educational mission, conflicts with the message that the school wants to send. And so again, even though that case involved a newspaper, Justice Brennan pointed out that if you follow the logic of Hazelwood and extend it outside that into a T-shirt kind of case, then the school would have a lot more leeway to restrict speech than it would under Tinker. And then moving on to the Morse case, one thing that I found interesting in reading Morse and a lot of the commentary that deals with that is, for the most part, it seems that the prevailing view is that Morse really jeopardizes or has the potential to jeopardize student speech. A lot of authors are concerned that even though the case involved the bong hits for Jesus sign, and the majority said that it was viewing it as a pro-drug advocacy, or not advocacy, but advocating the actual use of drugs, that a lot of people have been concerned that that opinion could be stretched to allow schools to censor any speech that either advocates something that's dangerous for students, like underage drinking or promiscuous sexual activity. But to me, the reality is there's been a few commentators that have pointed out that if you read Morse as what the majority says it is, in a case not involving political advocacy, not involving religious speech, but involving simply a, albeit crude, effort to advocate the use of drugs, that in a sense Morse doesn't hurt student speech. And in my opinion, there's a few passages in the opinion and the concurring opinions that actually bolster student speech. One of them particularly addressing Frazier and the argument made by the school district that that speech is just generally offensive in a sense of what it's advocating, that under Frazier they could use that standard. And the majority opinion in Morse pointed out that a lot of political and religious speech would be considered offensive, yet it would not fall as being under the Frazier standard of what could be proscribed. And then in the concurring opinion of Justice Alito, which Kennedy joined, they specifically addressed that they are not supporting any view that would allow censorship of political speech, and they rejected the educational mission argument in pretty strong language, that if you allowed a school district to censor speech that it deemed to be contrary to the educational mission of the school and the goals of the school, then that would wipe out virtually a lot of student expression, because a lot of school boards, particularly at the local level, or at least some of them, have incorporated some sense of political or social advocacy into their curriculum. In other words, if that were the case, a school could dictate any specific principle or goal that relates to politics, relates to social issues, as part of their mission, and then suppress any speech that was contrary to that. And the concurring opinion expressly rejected that. Now, in terms of our article, what we really focused on were five lower court opinions, a couple at the Court of Appeals level, a couple at the Federal District Court level, that really illustrated some different views. In three of them, the courts ruled in favor of the speaker, and in two of them, the courts ruled in favor of the school district, but they really illustrated, between the majority opinions and the dissenting opinions, a lot of different views about pro-life speech, speech dealing with gay rights issues, and how that plays out in the school setting. And I'll hit on one on each side real briefly. One case, Nixon versus Northern Local School District, was an Ohio District Court case, and on the front of the T-shirt it said "intolerant" in capital letters, and then it said, quote, "Jesus said, 'I'm the way, the truth, and the life,' John 14:6. That was on the front of the T-shirt. Now, as I had said previously, reasonably any religious speech could be viewed as controversial, potentially disruptive, and that's, I would say that certainly does fall under a general level, because pretty much any religious view outside of a Christian view that opposes, you know, that's a bold statement to make. It's a central principle of Christianity, and a lot of students from other faiths might find that offensive. Yet, I would argue that that's certainly not something that school districts could censor. Now, it gets more controversial on the back of the T-shirt where it says, quote, homosexuality is a sin, exclamation point. Islam is a lie, exclamation point. Abortion is murder, exclamation point. Some issues are just black and white. Now, admittedly, that's a lot more controversial and in-your-face than the front of the T-shirt. But again, the relevant principle and standard, in my opinion, should be, going back to the Tinker case, is that shirt, in and of itself, reasonably likely to cause substantial disruption in the order and workings of the school? In that case, the court held that it did not, that in other words, that the student had the right to wear that shirt, and for one reason, there was not any real evidence of disruption in the school, but also pointing to the offense, certainly that is offensive to a lot of people. Muslims directly, any students that may have had an abortion in the school would probably find that offensive, but the court emphasized that those are the kinds of things that are protected under Tinker, that if there were some evidence of violence, of past issues, of a likelihood that would spark something that would break out into violence or just even broad disorder in the school, then that could be enough to censor it. But in this case, that wasn't the case. And then conversely, I would say the main opinion at the lower court level on the opposing side is at the Ninth Circuit, Harper versus Poway Unified School District of 2006. And that shirt was stated, quote, be ashamed. Our school has embraced what God has condemned. Homosexuality is shameful. And the background for that case is that, as happens in a lot of schools, there was a day of silence every year that gay students and advocates and allies don't participate in classes and often wear tape on their mouths to signify discrimination against gay students and to bring attention to those issues. And then at some schools, they have what's called the Day of Truth that often occurs the same week, where it's other students do something similar, promoting their view of often religious beliefs that are contrary to that. Well, this school district would not allow the student to wear the shirt, and in a 2-1 panel opinion, the Ninth Circuit affirmed that decision. And one of the significant thing about that is there's language in Tinker that says that a student's speech can't interfere with the rights of others, and most courts have either ignored that or just treated it as dicta and not found it really significant. But the Harper case was really the first case to use that as a basis for decision. And the Harper case held, the majority held that the shirt essentially violated the rights of others because students have a right to go to a school and have an environment where they're not psychologically attacked, where they're not harassed, where they're not assaulted through speech or otherwise, and the court held that was the case. And in fact, the court used several what I would consider extreme hypotheticals to compare that to the shirt, including Jews are condemned to hell, or a shirt that says all Muslims are evildoers, or using a swastika or a Confederate flag. And the majority compared the T-shirt to those things and said a school can censor all of those. And then finally, the dissenting opinion completely disagreed with that and held there was no disruption under Tinker, therefore that should be allowed. And that the majority opinion had created a standard out of thin air from that rights of others language and in essence had gutted Tinker. And so in closing, I think that's an issue that's currently not resolved and probably won't be for a while, is which of those two views in this kind of a case should prevail, or is it somewhere in between? Should you have an opinion where students can wear pretty much whatever they want to, even if it's very extreme, or do you have a view where pretty much any criticism of the gay rights agenda or the push for same-sex marriage would not be allowed? And oftentimes, I'm guessing that in the future, courts will probably fall somewhere in between. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wolf?
I'm actually going there.
Okay.
Well, I'm sort of going to operate in a parallel universe from everything you've been hearing here, because I get to deal with the teachers, the impact of Tinker on teachers in the last 40 years. And let me just first of all start and say again thanks to American University and the Law Review staff for putting this all together, and Ms. Tinker to be here as well. It was quite an honor to see that, and also my condolences to the Law Review staff for having to blue book our articles. But aside from that, the parallel universe I was talking about relates to really two words, and it's actually in several citations that people, when they've quoted it today, they left out those two words, and this is what often happens. Justice Fortas's language says that neither students nor teachers or teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. And while obviously Tinker dealt with a student's or several students' rights, the court in its wisdom decided to apply this broader and include teachers in that. And since then, of course, we've seen various movement away from that that broad theme. I'm going to try and talk about that today. One of the reasons, actually, I think why Tinker is such a well-known case, and maybe this is a little self-serving for my point here, but is that, as everyone says, history is written by the victors. Well, in this case, the victor, one of the victors or victors were teachers. And so teachers had the opportunity to use this and to discuss it in their classrooms. And so it became a real learning tool, as somebody mentioned earlier, a teachable moment, which educators love that phrase because, you know, it's great. We can work something into our lesson plan. It's always a good thing. But it is somewhat ironic, given that most people do not think of Tinker as a teacher's case. One of the things I'm going to return to, and really a central focus of my article, but also of the discussion today, and it plays off something that Professor Raskin was talking about, which is the impact that the decision had on democracy and democratic freedoms. And teachers really are at the center of this. And it's actually an issue. I mean, teachers, the goal of a good teacher is to push students, to question them, to raise issues that are controversial. And sometimes that, most oftentimes, that can raise some eyebrows and also cause some disciplinary problems. I think Socrates who said, great teacher, I cannot teach anybody, I can only make them think. And that's really, and that role is really what creates the gray area and puts teachers in the spotlight. To give you a little better example, and nobody's used any jokes here, so I feel I can use one. There was a report, I assume it was somewhat real, there was a school, a middle school in Oregon, to give you an idea of how important a teacher's role is. It was a middle school in Oregon, and they had a unique problem. It was a bunch of the girls in the school were beginning to use lipstick. And so they would go to the bathroom in the middle of the day, and they would put on their lipstick, which was fine. But then they would, to test it, and some of you may recall it, so they would go up to the mirror and, you know, test it out with a little kiss on the mirror. And that would leave this lipstick, which, as you know, if you've ever had to wash a glass, is not easy to remove. And that would leave that there. And so, you know, the janitorial staff was all upset, and they contacted the administration, and a teacher brought all the girls down to the bathroom and brought a janitor in and said, you know, this is really a problem. Let's look at this and see what the problem actually is. And she said, she put the lipstick was up there, and she asked the janitor to go and clean it. Janitor took out his mop, dipped it in the toilet, wiped the mirror. No more problem with that. So it was a real learning thing and really a good use of the education. So now, no word on whether there was any litigation for shocking those students or not, but it's... let me start with a few basics, since we really haven't talked at all about teachers, a few basics about sort of where teachers come into the equation, because their rights are relatively limited as a whole. And as it relates to strict speech, there's really not a lot of I don't want to say a lot of problems. There are plenty of problems, but there's not a lot of movement to be had there. To begin with, the direct classroom speech that we're talking about, and that would be a case where a teacher would wear a political button into the classroom, as happens nearly every election season. Those kind of things are pretty basic issues that are not a real problem. I mean, there's still people who challenge them, but the rule there is you're not allowed to indoctrinate, and most teachers understand that. You're allowed to talk about a candidate. You're allowed to talk about a candidate in the context of a broader educational discussion, and that's actually a good lesson. But in some sense, it's actually like religious viewpoints. You can't talk about only one religious viewpoint. You have to do. You can't talk about just a Christian point of viewpoint. You have to say that as a historical lesson. So then there's the second part, and I'll get to this, which is more where most of the litigation is sort of what's called extracurricular speech. But this is where, again, the gray area is. It's not necessarily extracurricular, but this relates to questions where teachers are challenging issues of budgetary cuts, questions relating to the overall school, so that this actually concerns their job and the future of the school. But then they are disciplined for talking about that, and I'll get into why that's it. And there's also a new and growing issue, which I will get back to later, which is technology, because so many things now come in terms of the social networking. You know, you have a teacher has a blog or a teacher has a Facebook page, not intended for their students to see, but as everyone knows, also very very difficult to wall that off. And so it leads to assorted lawsuits good artwork on a teacher's blog or Facebook page that was not intended for everyone to see. So there are really two basic limits or styles of limit on what a teacher can do. One is sort of the political structure. And that's been established and it's been laid out by the Supreme Court, and that is that it's school boards, not teachers, who get to control the curriculum, or administration, not teachers, who get to control the curriculum. And the Supreme Court stated, there's no single tradition in public education more deeply rooted than local control over the operation of schools. And then later, in the case that most of you know, Board of Education v. PICO, the court basically said that it's the duty of the school boards to prescribe curriculum matters. So there's not really much debate there. Teachers can't come in, and most curriculum is prescribed. You have to have it approved by the board, or by the administration. So that's less of a problem. Then there's the other issue of indoctrination, which I mentioned earlier. And you know, we have these impressionable youth in our schools, and the question of whether a teacher is allowed to talk about things that either a parent should be talking about, or for that matter, some people feel nobody should be talking about. The student should learn them where everyone does, picks them up on the street. So you've got, and there's a lowering level there. In other words, if you're talking to kindergartners or third graders, you have much less leeway in what you can say. High school, you have a little bit more, although obviously the Hazelwood decision limited a little bit of that. And then, of course, when you get to the college level, there's many fewer limits, although there are still some limits at public universities. But one assumes that most college students are adults or should be treated as adults anyway. And so therefore, there's less of a problem there. And we won't deal with that really at all today. But it gets us back to that issue of what the very nature of teaching is. And it's the how to get students to communicate, to learn to think, to express themselves, and really to be essential parts of the democracy that we live in. So out of this, there are two strands of legal analysis. The first strand, which is the Tinker and Hazelwood strand, and I won't go into the need to discuss the legal standards, but what's interesting is that there is no real individual cases that apply to teachers on this at the Supreme Court level. They took the student cases and they sort of shoved teachers into this with those two words and with a few other things, and they've always applied student cases to teachers. And as I'll discuss later, that's a little bit of a problem. But I think it's important to mention how this happened and how the impact of these cases, the negative impact of these cases on teachers. And Justice Brennan in Hazelwood, in his dissent, noted that the ruling presents a clear and dangerous impact, not just on students, but on the role played by educators themselves. It is particularly insidious from one whom the public entrusts the task of inculcating in its youth an appreciation for the cherished democratic liberties that our Constitution guarantees. So again, it's the idea of pedagogical, legitimate pedagogical concerns when you're dealing with teachers is not one that's easy to define. I mean, most people actually associate all of the pedagogical concerns with teachers and with the school, and they associate the teacher's views with the school, which isn't necessarily the case. There's a second strain of cases, however, and that deals with the extracurricular speech, or as I defined it, the extracurricular speech. And that's called, and I'll get to each of these cases, the Pickering, Connick, Garcetti line of cases. And so I think almost all of these cases have been talked about. But Pickering, let's start with that one, which was decided the year before Tinker, actually. And that involved a local public school teacher who had written to the board, to the local newspaper, criticizing the superintendent for how they were spending school funds. And they upheld the teacher's right to express their views, and the court embraced the importance, again, of the teacher's role to the community, particularly their role in being an expert on education and what goes on in the school. And so this was a very important thing. Now, there was a qualifier, but it was nothing really new. Justice Thurgood Marshall included a balancing test in which he said that he would balance the interest of the teacher as a citizen in commenting on matters of public concern and the interest of the state as an employer in promoting the efficiency of public service as it performs through its employees. All very sort of generic, appropriate, sensible language, but all of which would take very negative turns as it related to speech later, and we'll get to that. In fact, the next case that came up was in Connick v. Myers, the second of this sort of trilogy. And Sheila Myers, this was not a teacher case, but another assistant district attorney. And Connick used this balancing test, but it really focused on whether the speech was a matter of public concern. And in a rationale that seemed actually remarkably similar to Hazelwood about the need to maintain discipline in the schools, the court explained that the government as an employer must have wide discretion and control over the management of its personnel and internal affairs. It did seem harmless enough at the time, however, but it would come up much later and would be applied in very negative ways. One of the best examples of this was a case from 1998 called Boring v. Buncombe County Board of Education. And there's actually somebody earlier was talking about the Law Review article titles. There's a very good Law Review article about boring is not boring or something like that. So, you know, there are a few people that play a little bit with some of these things. But in any case, this was a case of a high school drama teacher who had picked a somewhat controversial play for her drama class, but it was actually then used really just for a contest, a statewide contest. And she'd had approval from the school board. And when some parents got hold of it, and parents got very upset, and the drama students were allowed to go through, and they actually won the state competition, but this teacher was subsequently suspended. When she challenged that, and it went to the appeals court, and the boring court said that the play was curricular in nature, and therefore, by definition, a legitimate pedagogical concern, applying Hazelwood, of course. And they further noted that the play was not, as outlined in Connick, a matter simply an ordinary employment dispute. And I have to quote from a concurrence by Judge Luttig, who is not known for his he's not bashful in the way he says it, but it gets to a point that I'm going to get back to later, which is sort of jumping on teachers, but also really thinking about them as as more opinionated, I guess, or more political than they are. And he said that he made clear his need for deference to school boards because he said that were every public school teacher in America to have the constitutional right to design, even in part, the content of his or her individual classes, schools would become mere instruments for the advancement of the individual and collective social agendas of teachers. One assumes that he doesn't feel that most teachers share his agenda. But even if they did, it would not be a good thing. Now, the final nail in this coffin is one that Professor Raskin referred to in the context of public employees, and it had an especially problematic and effect for teachers, and that was Garcetti v. Ceballos. He's already outlined the facts of that, but basically what they ended up doing is adding this idea that when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes. And the Constitution, therefore, doesn't insulate their communications from any discipline. And so when the Ceballos was, this was the case about the warrant, this was not a it was a case about a warrant, it was part of his job description. So in any case, this led to a real problem for teachers because everything got put in this whole, this little room of, oh, that's part of your job description. Let me give you a couple examples because this is really where we are in the law right now. In the Seventh Circuit a few years back in Meyer v. Monroe County, the court rejected the appeal of a teacher who had been dismissed because she had offered her personal political views in a classroom current events discussion. She wasn't trying to dictate them. She had just offered them. The court rejected out of hand her argument about principles of academic freedom and that they shouldn't apply the Garcetti standard. And they basically said, public school teachers must hew to the approach prescribed by principals and others higher up in the chain of authority. Not so bad right there. But then you always get one of these judges who decides to extemporaneize a little bit. And so Judge Frank Easterbrook, another very intelligent and verbose judge, basically said, the school system does not regulate teachers' speech as much as it hires that speech. Expression is a teacher's stock and trade, the commodity she sells to her employer in exchange for a salary. A teacher hired to lead a social studies class can't use it as a platform for a revisionist perspective that Benedict Arnold wasn't really a traitor when the approved program calls him one. A high school teacher hired to explicate Moby Dick in a literature class can't use Cry the Beloved Country instead, even if Peyton's book better suits the instructor's style and point of view. And a math teacher can't decide that calculus is more important than trigonometry and decide that he goes on. He likes to show his own knowledge on this as well, but he also makes clear his point of view. But the most bizarre and really counterproductive outgrowth of Garcetti is not sort of these issues of curriculum. As I said, that's not that much of a problem. I mean, there are cases of it, and I'm sure we'll hear about them. But the bigger issue is, as Justice Stevens stated in his Garcetti's dissent, it seems perverse to fashion a new rule that provides employers with an incentive to voice their concern publicly before talking frankly to their superiors. And he cited a case called Given v. Western Line Consolidated School District, saying we had no difficulty recognizing that the First Amendment applied when Bessie Given, an English teacher, raised concern about the school's racist employment practices to the principal. But with Garcetti, that would be a problem. In fact, in a case in New York, a teacher who had reported on a supervisor's sexual harassment was forced to resign because he was not protected in that speech, even though the state law mandated that he report it. So he was caught in the middle. Now, there are some answers to that in the sense that there are certain retaliatory actions taken against an educator that you're protected in by other federal laws. But in most cases, there's this gap. And so for essentially doing your job, for highlighting negative things, you end up, if not out on the street, at least relocated. So then what do we say? This is where the law is right now. So and what does this mean now for decades after Tinker? Unfortunately, the two primary strands of legal analysis, the Tinker-Hazelwood and the Pickering-Garcetti line of cases, don't give us much in the way of either intellectually satisfying nor legally sound answers. Hazelwood, as I mentioned, it's not about teachers. And so it really doesn't offer a lot of answers. It can be applied, but it can be applied in very awkward ways. And the Pickering-Garcetti line, basically, as one very informed commentator noted, is strained, contrived, and nonsensical. That wasn't me as the commentator, by the way. I don't want anybody to think that. There's somebody else who believes that. But the interesting thing is that there are opportunities here for changing the law, even though, like with student speech, teacher speech has, you know, been whittled away to next to nothing, there is a real opportunity here to turn it around, I think. And so there are sort of three areas that I suggest that we can do this, and I'll address these fairly quickly. Number one is to develop legislative and or contractual responses. Since Hazelwood, a number of local and state governments have enacted or sought to enact legislation. And these are primarily designed to protect student rights, and Frank may actually talk a little bit more about this. But some of these have pulled in teachers and protect teachers as well. it's very difficult to do it because of all those restrictions that are imposed by school boards and whatever. But when they're related, when they're advisors to student newspapers, or sometimes even when they're just talking about very basic issues in the context of broad learning, these can be included. You also, of course, then get into political issues. There's a movement going on about what's called academic freedom, but it's really intended, and it's been an effort by conservative activists to protect conservative points of view. So in Florida, for example, there was a bunch of bills that were introduced to protect teachers and students from harassment or retaliation, such as when you are teaching when you're teaching any type of what would generically be termed a conservative point of view, but for instance, creationism. So a state legislature down there introduced comparable legislation to make it broad and to cover all points of view, but needless to say, it was soundly rejected by the Republican-controlled Senate down there. There's a second area, though, where probably there's a little better opportunity to protect some of these rights, and that's through the contract. Okay, that's through the contract process. And while teachers don't have a teacher press law center, which they probably could use that, but they do have contracts, and so they need to do a better job negotiating them. More and more contracts are including freedom of speech or freedom of expression provisions in their contract. The other issue that what really needs to be dealt with, and I could talk about it in questions, is the issue of protecting speech on the private Facebook website, that kind of thing, because right now anything they do anywhere almost can be drawn in under the Garcetti standard if students can get to it. And I should add, teachers' private lives have not really ever been private, though. There's a 1915 document that you'll see sometimes tacked to teacher workroom walls, which basically outlines the rules for teachers and says, you are not to keep company with men, and you must under no circumstances dye your hair. So there's a real need here to rehabilitate the role of teachers, that to get away from, for instance, Judge Luttig's view that teachers are just out there to indoctrinate their kids. Most of the teachers are really just trying to get through the day, trying to, as Jamie suggested, just try to conduct a good, intelligent discussion, teach their kids how to ask the right questions. But not all teachers are alike. Teacher free speech cases don't fit into a neat single pattern, because teachers don't fit into a neat single pattern. And so, it's very important that we address these and figure out what the real needs are here. Because how rigorous our schools are, how well we challenge our students, is really going to help us shape our education system for the future. As a very important case, Sweezy v. New Hampshire, which was a case that came out of the McCarthy era, they noted, teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die. We are, as a nation, to continue to be defined by such bold and common-sense philosophies. We must restore that understanding and approach. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks, everyone. I can't say that I'm terribly sorry that Mary Beth had to leave to catch her plane, because it's really intimidating to talk about the Tinker case when you're looking at Tinker. It's a little bit like talking about civil rights and having MLK walk down the hall and take a seat in the front row, right? So I can't say I'm terribly sorry about that. My name is Frank Lamani. I'm the director of the Student Press Law Center, and by my profession, by my occupation, I'm an advocate for the First Amendment rights of student journalists. But in my personal life, I am also the son of a 20-year high school administrator, a former assistant principal and guidance counselor in one of the tougher New York City schools, and My father, being the only combat infantry veteran among the school administrators, was invariably the one tasked with disarming the students in the not infrequent knife fights that occurred on the premises. And I will tell you, I wish he could be here to tell you, but I will tell you that in 20 years of doing that, my father never took a knife away from the editor of the yearbook or the editor of the newspaper. The kids that we help, the kids that are suffering the brunt of unlawful censorship in our schools, are not your problem kids. They're some of the best kids in the school. They're students who are all college bound. They're students that, if they achieved highly in any other field, in band, in music, in theater, in sports, they would be celebrated. They would be celebrated and held up as role models by the school. But because they achieve highly in journalism, too often they're shunned, they're disciplined, they're preventing from exercising their craft. Student Press Law Center has a hotline for students to call an attorney. The simple questions we answer ourselves, the hard ones we farm out to volunteer attorneys, and I don't spend a lot of time answering that hotline because I spend a lot of time doing things like this, but every once in a while I do pick up the phone and take calls, and I was there last week and I did pick up the phone and take a call from a student down in high school in Florida. I'm going to obscure the facts for reasons that will be obvious. The student was the editor of her high school, co-editor of her high school newspaper. They wanted to write a story about the way that the school had disciplined a student in excess of the school's lawful disciplinary authority. The facts were that the student went onto the comment section, the comment board of his local school district's website, and where public comments were solicited, the student wrote in a derogatory comment about a proposed school district policy, and at the conclusion of his remarks said that the superintendent who is proposing this policy is a dumbass. He signed it anonymously, a student. The school district used the URL to track the address of the commenter, tracked him down and punished him, put a disciplinary referral in his record. This is a student who's on the honor roll and is college bound and is now frightened that this has been jeopardized. And when the student newspaper learned of this imposition of discipline, they started investigating. They found out that the rule under which the student was punished did not apply to his conduct. It was about the misuse of school computers during the school day on school premises. So they wanted to write about this. They wanted to expose the fact that the discipline was without legal basis and was unfounded. They tried to write a story. They interviewed the principal. The principal, who normally did not, in fact, review the content of the newspaper before it went to press, insisted that she be allowed to read this story. When she read the story, she said, "You will not publish this story." And the story was not published. The story was withheld. The student called me up. "You will not see this case. You will not see this case in court. You will never see this case in a federal reporter." And the reason is because the student is terrified. The student is petrified that if she speaks out and if she takes this case to court, the principal will fire her teacher or will interfere with her status as valedictorian of her class. So we're talking about the best kid in the class who comes to school every day frightened. That is really what's going on in our schools. I would like to tell you that that is an exceptional case. I would like to tell you that's the worst case we've had this year. That's not even the worst phone call I got last Tuesday. We get 4 calls like that every day. Every day. That's the reality of what is going on in our schools. And I'm starting with these facts because it is the facts that are dictating the outcome of the First Amendment cases that we're seeing today that involve school law. If you're ever, tip to you law students, if you're ever given a choice between a case with the good facts and the case with the good law, take the good facts. You'll win a lot more. Right? The cases that we're seeing coming out of the federal courts today involving student speech are almost unabashedly policy-driven and results-oriented, with only so much First Amendment doctrine as is necessary to make sure that the school wins and the student loses. Okay? And it's not surprising that we end up with that result, because the facts are almost always the driving force that underlies judicial decisions. And indeed, if you read the Tinker case, right, it is impossible to read the Tinker case and to think about where it falls in American history without seeing Judge Fortas's outrage at the waste of young lives in Vietnam and at the fact that these students were themselves next in line to be draft eligible, right? It is impossible not to see that underlying Justice Fortas's decision. The way that the facts are being laid out today in judicial decisions invariably stacks the deck in favor of the school and against the student, because when you frame up the case as a case of the overworked, harried school administrator against the violence-prone, disrespectful student, right? When you traffic in stereotypes, when you deal in stereotypes, it is impossible not to come out 99 times out of 100 with a result that upholds even the most irrational disciplinary decision by a school, okay? But let's not forget that public schools are the government, right? Public schools are the government. And when you frame the case not as the overworked, harried school administrator against the dangerous, violence-prone student, but as the government versus the speaker, or as in my Orlando case, right, the government versus the whistleblower, right, you realize that you may be pointing toward a different outcome, because we never let the government silence whistleblowers, right? That offends our notions of basic propriety. And so the way that these cases are being framed up today says a lot about the way they're going to come out. And I suggest that courts need to take account of the full panoply of the facts that are out there on the ground. Yes, it is true. The vast majority of school administrators come to work every day with the goal of seeing their students succeed and thrive and emerge with a good education. But just as we have laws against murder, right, not for you and not for you and not for you and not for me, but for that small minority of people who needs a law against murder to deter them, we have the First Amendment to act as a deterrent against that small minority of school administrators who do not come to work every day with the best intentions of the students in mind, but who come to work every day with the mentality that one principal expressed to me, that I am the warden and these are the inmates and I am running an asylum, and it is my job to just keep them from killing each other. Right? So the focus of my contribution to the symposium is on the effort in at least some of our federal courts to shrink the scope of Tinker from what it has been accepted as, and is still in the majority of circuits today accepted as, which is the broad background rule under which all student speech cases are to be decided, right? And to shrink that down to a case that is only about political speech and sometimes only about viewpoint discrimination. The Ninth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit have all said in recent years that Tinker supplies the standard only in cases of viewpoint discrimination. Some of them are doing this seizing on language in the Morse versus Frederick case, the Bong Hits for Jesus case that you heard about earlier today, right, which said that Tinker is not absolute. And we see that phrase coming back to us again and again. Tinker is not absolute. It is painful to see Tinker downgraded in this manner, because it's such an elegant and such a carefully struck compromise that there's almost no improving on it. If you think about the careful choice that Justice Fortas made when he coined the standard that speech may not be punished unless it materially and substantially interferes with schoolwork or discipline, right? This is an elegant compromise. Anybody who's ever spent time in school, and I'm in schools quite a lot these days, knows, right, that schools operate at sort of a constant low level of disruption. Every single day, there is a background level of disruption. There are fights, there are rivalries, there are breakups, there are games being played. When I was a high school student, it was mandatory that the cheerleaders come to school every Friday on a football Saturday wearing their cheerleading uniforms, including the miniskirts. And I can tell you that that was exponentially more disruptive than Mary Beth Tinker's armband ever could have been to a 15-year-old boy. So Tinker reflects a carefully crafted judicial compromise between the full First Amendment rights that you and I all enjoy when we walk around as citizens of the world, and Justice Thomas's view that there should be none at all. And we should not lightly discard that careful compromise. The circuits that I classify in my article as the Tinker Shrinkers point to, first, the facts of Tinker. And as a basis for holding that it is only about viewpoint discrimination, right? And what they say is, looking at the regulation that was at issue at Tinker, it is clear, it is unmistakable, that the school meant to suppress a particular viewpoint, that is the viewpoint that the Vietnam War was wrong. But the Supreme Court has subsequently told us, in the case of Hill versus Colorado, this is a 2000 decision that involved a Colorado law protecting the rights of people to walk in and out of abortion clinics without being proselytized by people getting into their physical space. Right? The Supreme Court told us in that case that the fact that the law was motivated by the conduct of one side in a controversy, as that clearly was, it was clearly motivated by a desire to silence only anti-abortion forces, because there was no evidence that pro-abortion forces were getting in the face of patients as they left and entered clinics. The fact that it was motivated by a desire to suppress one side in a dispute was of no constitutional moment. The question was it being enforced in a viewpoint discriminatory manner? And in the absence of evidence it was enforced in a viewpoint discriminatory manner, it was constitutional. And so it is in Tinker. Tinker may have been motivated by a desire to suppress an unpopular viewpoint, but it was not, either on its face or in its enforcement, an act of viewpoint discrimination. And it is just wrong to classify Tinker on that basis as a viewpoint discrimination case. The most powerful evidence to me that Tinker is about more than just viewpoint is to look at the trilogy of student speech cases from the Supreme Court that have followed Tinker, and we've talked about those all day long. I won't go over their facts today, but in each and every one of these cases, the Bethel versus Frazier case, the Hazelwood versus Kohlmeier case, and the Morse versus Frederick case, the Supreme Court has had an opportunity to say, we decide this case under Tinker. There is no viewpoint discrimination here. There is no political opinion being suppressed, and we rule on that basis. The Supreme Court has not done so, and instead has taken pains and gone out of its way to carve out exceptions to Tinker rather than applying Tinker as if it were no more than about political viewpoint. So again, the way that the Supreme Court understands Tinker is at odds with the way the Ninth, the Fifth, and the Sixth Circuits are applying it today. Tinker speaks in terms of the special characteristics of the school environment. And we understand that to mean, that has come to mean, that schools need to have latitude to make snap disciplinary decisions in volatile situations without fear of being second-guessed. That's understood. That's appreciated. But if we're going to recognize special First Amendment rules that apply only in the school environment, then we have to consider the totality of the school environment. And an essential part of that environment is that students are not just captive listeners, which was a phrase used in the Bethel v. Frazier case, they're also captive speakers, right? They spend the best part of each and every day captive in a place where the law requires them to be, and indeed, not only that the law requires them to be, but that they have a legally enforceable right to be that cannot be taken away from them without the benefit of due process. So that students on school premises are not like a bystander, an ordinary citizen who wants to go into the municipal park and speak, and it is just wrong, as some of the courts are doing today, to try to import elements of the forum doctrine, which would apply to a public park, into the unique environment of the school. And part of those special characteristics of the school environment are that, unlike in any other forum for speech, right? The principal acts very frequently as the judge, jury, and executioner in carrying out discipline. There is often no meaningful appeal because you've already served the suspension, you've already been sent home before you can have a hearing, and it is incredibly hard to discipline a school administrator. They are not subject to the same types of constraints as a teacher. In most states, they do not go through the same type of teacher certification and licensure where a person could bring a complaint to a licensure board if they feel that the official has acted out of line. Your recourse against a school administrator is to get 3 votes on a school board, and that's awfully difficult for a 15-year-old. So the special characteristics of the school environment also counsel in favor of very clearly delineated constraints on when schools can and can't punish. Right? If you follow the reasoning of the Fifth and the Ninth and the Sixth Circuits, you have to ask yourself, if not Tinker, then what? Right? If Tinker is not the rule, then what does supply that background standard? And the question is not an academic question. It's really a fundamental question rooted as much in due process as in the First Amendment, right? If we say Tinker is about political viewpoints and Bethel v. Frazier is about using lewd speech in a school assembly setting and Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeier is about speaking in a curricular student publication and Morse v. Frazier is about encouraging illegal drug use, then what about all the rest of that speech, that vast middle ground that is none of those things? What supplies the standard? And the answer is, regrettably, if that is your view of the law, that the standard gets made up as we go along on an ad hoc and indeed a post hoc basis by the courts after the fact when a case is brought to them, right? And we have constitutional rulemaking that entirely fails to put the speaker on notice of what conduct is and is not prohibited, which is the absolute minimum that due process requires. Okay. Just a minute or two on a case where this has been playing out. In fact, a very contemporary case, one that's going to be argued in June in front of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, called J.S. versus Blue Mountain. It's a case that involves a student at a public middle school who used an internet page to make some very harsh remarks ridiculing her principal. It was a sort of a parody page, and everybody understood it as being a spoof, but it was incredibly harsh and unkind page, and the student was suspended from school for doing this, even though there was no physical nexus whatsoever with the school, and in fact, the school as much as conceded, and the district court found as a fact that there was no substantial disruption of school at all. Okay, so under normal Tinker analysis, we have no First Amendment basis on which that speech can be disciplined. But what the district court did was, using the Morse language and saying that Tinker is not absolute, it cobbled together this makeshift standard using pieces of 3 other First Amendment cases and came out with a standard that says, well, schools could punish vulgar, lewd, and potentially illegal speech that has an effect on campus. Okay? That's the standard under which you're supposed to go forth and govern yourself if this case becomes the rule. And if we're going to have ad hoc makeshift rulemaking like that, students are not going to have fair notice of what conduct is and is not prohibited. Let me sort of speed ahead I think JS is a good point for us to talk a little bit about what is going on today in internet speech and online speech. And in my view, the need for a robust Tinker rule, the need for a meaningful Tinker rule, has never been more urgent because schools are now asserting authority not only over what students do on school premises during school time and using school facilities, but even where none of those things is true, even where students are speaking in a capacity when we would normally think of them as citizens, right? The Tinker said that when you show up at the schoolhouse gate, at least the implication of Tinker is that when you showed up at the schoolhouse gate, you still had all your First Amendment rights. You had to lay some of them down at the schoolhouse gate, but you at least showed up and brought them with you to the schoolhouse gate. We can't confidently say that anymore. But because schools are seeking to punish entirely off-campus speech on the basis that it has the potential of reaching campus, let's think about what that means. If a student is told that you cannot engage in speech that may cause discussion at school, then we may be living in a world in which the student could literally be told, not only can you not blow the whistle in the student newspaper, not only can you not blow the whistle in an official publication, but do not go to your local newspaper, do not go to your local TV station, do not speak in front of the school board, do not go public with any of your concerns, or I will punish you for that. That cannot be the law. That cannot be the law. I'm getting the hook here. I should wrap it up. Students may not be constitutional scholars, but students do have a very highly developed and pronounced sense of what is right and wrong and what is fair and unfair. And when students see that punishment is being dealt out excessively and that courts bend the law and make up new rules on the fly to justify the result that they want to reach, their respect for the rule of the law and for the integrity of our institutions of government, and yes, for the legitimacy of school authority, is corroded. And that is the absolute opposite of what schools ought to be seeking. Thanks.
Finally, Mr. Harbin.
Okay. I thank you for the opportunity to be the last speaker on this rather long day, and I'm sure that following Frank's eloquent argument here to the appellate courts in the case, and I'm sure you're going to win, whatever case that may be. But it didn't come from Georgia. Okay, why am I on this panel with this distinguished group of scholars? And I think it was because I was practicing law and actually represented a school district when Tinker was handed down. That's been a few years ago. I was only 12 at the time, but I'm admitted early to the bar, but that's the occasion. At that time, the only school law practice that I needed to do was to be able to review a few contracts, maybe handle a real estate transaction for the Board of Education. Wasn't much else to do. And then Tinker was decided, then Frazier was decided, then Goss v. Lopez, Pickering, all the way down to Connick and Garcetti. And Congress was very helpful, too. It passed Title VI and IX and Title VII and Section 504, the Rehabilitation Act, and special education law, a lot of regulations applying to this. So all of this created a school law practice, and I owe a great thanks to Mary Beth Tinker for beginning this process. Is this, however, good for public education or for the public generally? There are those who would contend that we no longer have a schoolhouse gate, that the fence has come down. We have so much legislation and so many court decisions. There's such a vast amount of litigation that involves student issues, teacher issues, all centering on First Amendment issues as well, religious issues. When I get back to the office on Monday, I know that I have a small firm. We do exclusively, we represent exclusively school districts. That's all we do. I know that what we're going to be dealing with next week will involve students on several due process issues, discipline, student discipline issues, none of which involves press, by the way, or school newspapers. We have real sadly, because of the financial situation, have a number of layoffs of teachers that I've got to handle, with teachers having the right to challenge these. We have drug issues in our schools. We have sexting is the new word now. I've got one case involving that. I'm not allowed to look at what the evidence is in that case. Internet issues that are constantly, dress code issues, all of these are questionable First Amendment issues. Children of undocumented residents of our school districts, and what issues there that those pose, school gangs, all of these things, including special education matters involving parents who are seeking residential placement for their children. or very expensive kinds of services that are being provided. So these are the sort of issues that go on in a school law practice. In the midst of this, we know that when we get into court, judges are going to ask the question, did the school principal, the teachers, did the Board of Education act in a reasonable manner in taking the actions that it did? Is this Tinker speech or Frazier speech when it comes to First Amendment issues? Did a classroom teacher understand that when he or she made a decision and carried out that decision on an instant reaction to a given problem that was presented, did that teacher understand how the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision ruled, as we sit here all day long debating exactly what it has, or as distinguished by some circuit court case, which may or may not be following the Supreme Court, did the teacher understand that there was a comment to a request for opinions by the U.S. Department of Education on a proposed regulation as to what that meant and how it would apply to a given situation. This is what is going on in the school system. In the last month, I have dealt with constitutional issues such as this one, unrelated to free speech. A principal calls me in an emergency. He says, there is a student in my school that is selling drugs. We know he's been selling drugs. It's been reported by very reliable informants that he currently has drugs on him that he is selling. We have searched him, and we cannot find the drugs. One kid came to us today. I know he's reliable. He says he has a package of cocaine that he is trying to sell. He has that on him, and I told the kid, the principal said, we have searched him before, and we can't find the drug. He said, don't you know where he's got it? And I didn't realize this was a verb, but he said, he's crotching the drugs. He's got them in his underwear. So the principal tells me, I have the kid in the office. I have him down to his shorts. I have a school resource officer present. Tell me, can I make him lower his shorts? That's the kind of questions that we get constitutionally. You know, the principal is saying, am I going to get sued? And your neck is on the line as well. Or do I let this kid sell drugs because I won't tell him to lower his shorts and then face the consequences of that as well? Perhaps some student, you know, overdosing or whatever may occur. So we have a lot of constitutional issues that we deal with. So let me just acquaint you with a situation that I want to talk about very briefly. And this involves a rural school district in Georgia. Very rural. It is, however, growing, and it is becoming more diversified. At the present time in the high school, there is almost an equal number of Caucasian students, African-American students, and Latino students. Now, there are a few boys, about 6 boys, who are athletes, who, because this is a rural district in Georgia, who have decided that they are a group that they call themselves rednecks. They take pride in that name, rednecks. And they in doing so, they sit together at ball games and cheer when they're not playing actually themselves in the particular sport. They are involved in a number of activities together. One of the boys has a battered pickup truck, which he takes great pride in, and has rednecks written on the truck. He comes to campus with a Confederate battle flag displayed. The assistant principal, who's out in the parking lot watching cars come in, tells him, take the flag off, put it in your vehicle. The kid does it, brings it the next day. The assistant principal says, if you bring it again, you're going to be suspended from school. So he doesn't bring it again. Instead, he has a decal on his car with a Confederate flag. The assistant principal is angry. The kid's laughing. He peels the decal off his bumper. The next day, the kid comes to school with a pickup truck, and the Confederate battle flag is painted on the truck. So we have that kind, we have that situation here. We have the other kids that are wearing various T-shirts to school, most of which involve a display of the Confederate battle flag. There's a company that actually sells these. They're called Dixie Outfitters, and they have these Confederate flags that they display on a regular basis. Students have been wearing these shirts. Finally, there's a kid that comes to school, and he has a T-shirt on and has the Confederate flag, and there's a message on the front of it: God loves Dixie. Is that a religious issue here? Okay. He also has on this T-shirt a statement that says, "We are Bible-believing, straight, unreconstructed Southerners." Political message, you know, religious message, you know, First Amendment. So the principal makes a rule: you're not going to bring any item of clothing with a Confederate flag displayed. The students, of course, are very upset because they said that these Latino students, there are a number of them, have been wearing clothes or having an emblem of the Mexican flag, and that's insulting to them. And that the African-American students are coming with, some of them have a T-shirt that's a Malcolm X T-shirt, and has a little label, I didn't know exactly what it means, F-U-B-U, for us, by us, which is indicating that it was manufactured by, I gather, by African-Americans for students. In any event, they say these ought to be banned as well. So the principal bans all of it, every bit of it, says none of it can be done. Now, nothing unites students more than having a rule that applies to all of them. We now have an ACLU lawyer who is involved. The superintendent is in the principal's office. We've got some violations of this directive. They are ready to suspend the students. In fact, they say, "We are suspending the students. You are our lawyer. You tell us how to do it legally." Oh, by the way, there is a Board of Education. It's a 7-member board. Three is generally split on most issues, 3-3, with the chair, the swing vote in this case. One of the board members' son, one board member has a son who is a redneck. Another board member is a former president of the local NAACP. And a third one is a pastor of a church where one of these kids attends, one of these kids that wears the T-shirts attends. So where's the board on this? They hire me and can fire me. And that's a profound question that I'm concerned about. Going through my mind at that time is this: in 24 to 48 hours, I could be before a federal district court judge on a motion brought by one of the plaintiffs seeking a restraining order to prevent the school from excluding the kids from school. I also wonder if in about 1 to 2 years I would be before a circuit court of appeals arguing whether or not any suspension of a student for committing these acts was lawful. And if I'm really lucky, in about 3 years, I could even have my case before the Supreme Court, in which some justice is leaning over the bench saying, "What in the world were you thinking when you gave that legal advice?" So quickly checking to see if my legal malpractice insurance is still in effect, I began to try to have to advise the Board of Education, or in this case, the superintendent. A recent case handed down by the 11th Circuit, and Georgia's in the 11th Circuit, is Scott versus the school board of Atchalooch County. Comes out of Florida, I believe. In that case, the students were displaying the Confederate battle flag on campus, and it was prohibited. Students were suspended. They went to court. They raised Tinker as the defense, the pure version of Tinker, no doubt, Frank, and in the matter. And in that case, the court had some interesting comments, and I'm just going to quote just a few of these. "Surely it is a highly appropriate function of a public school education to prohibit the use of vulgar and inappropriate terms in public discourse. Nothing in the Constitution prohibits states from insisting that certain modes of expression are inappropriate and subject to sanctions. The inculcation of these values is truly the work of schools, quoting the work of schools from Tinker. The determination of what manner of speech in the classroom or in the school assembly is inappropriately, properly rests with the school board. Schools teach by example the shared values of a civilized social order. Appropriate form of civil discourse and political expression by their conduct in and out of class. Part of a public school's essential mission must be to teach students differing races, creeds, and colors to engage each other in civil terms rather than in, quote, terms of debate highly offensive or highly threatening to others. And the case goes on. I won't quote at length from it. So that 11th Circuit decision gives me some basis of advising the Board of Education. But what it comes down to is, whose call is it? Frank is right when he says these cases are fact-intensive, and the facts will control the outcome of a case. Some of the cases that we've talked about today should never have been litigated because they had bad facts. One of the things I do on a regular basis is tell school districts, don't litigate something that's going to produce bad law and bad precedent. You know, cases are extraordinarily fact-intensive. When we have young lawyers who come to us from law school who are going to help us write appellate court briefs, we tell them, for the amount of time that you have to write the brief, three-fourths of that time ought to be in writing the facts in the case. And yet that's often the other way. It's often a minor kind of a approach to it, but the facts are critical. So who decides what the facts are? What is the standard when you look at the facts in a particularly given situation? Do we judge the principal in this case that I described, the superintendent, the board, to be in willful disregard of constitutional rights or having acted arbitrarily or capriciously? Or should the standard be, in judging a set of facts, what a reasonable, the negligence standard, what a reasonable, prudent, professional educator would do in the same or similar circumstances? If you look at this kind of standard, you have to realize when it becomes so fact-intensive. I represent about 125 school districts on a good day, and sometimes more or less from that figure. No school is the same. And sometimes when we read these cases, we look at it as if every school and every student body is the same. It's not. There is not a national norm for schools. Schools in Georgia, we have inner city schools. We have mountain schools that are pretty homogeneous. We have schools in the southern part of our state, South Georgia, which, while vestiges of illegal segregation are gone, attitudes still remain. You know, so we have different approaches, and we also learned that from class to class, any teacher knows this. A given class of 11th graders is different from the next class. Some are very serious, want to engage you in discussion. There are teachable moments, and they're responsive. Others just want to raise hell all the time. I don't know which class you came from, but you know that the classes themselves within the same school differ. So what do you do if it's not fact-intensive? You have to look at how you advise a school district in a given set of circumstances. You've got to know the community, and you've got to respond in that way. Yes, we may be looking at law that varies over a period of time as to what the courts are going to hold, but the bottom line of it is this. Courts need to listen to teachers and administrators about what the circumstances are in that school as applied the particular situation that's going to occur. So when you look at the facts, there's no two cases are the same. Yet we expect all of the cases to come out the same. So I suggest to you that this is a, when you start looking at what we have, when you start responding to cases like Tinker and Frazier and others, you have to be conscious of the facts, be conscious of the given circumstances that exist in advising a school district, and when you do advise the school district under those circumstances, then you hope that you can avoid your school district from getting sued. That's what they pay me to do, is not to win cases, but to keep them from being sued. And that's sometimes the most difficult thing that I do, is to keep them out of court. So that's pretty much what I've got to tell you as a practicing lawyer who's done this for a long time, other than if any of you want to be school district lawyers, you could see me after this session. Thank you very much.
I really want to thank each and every panelist for adding some compelling statements and arguments and discussion of cases that will continue in the next session. And I would like to encourage everybody to take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back, I think, at 3:25, if I'm reading the schedule correctly. Thank you again.
I can't.